Hello, and welcome to a fun bonus episode of Franchise Festival. This was just sort of an experimental idea that we'd been kicking around to repurpose some of our outtakes, and boy howdy do we have a lot of outtakes. In the Twilight Princess episodes alone, I think each of those ran for 4+ hours, but I got it down to 2 hours per episode in the editing room. So we had quite a bit of cut content, and particularly as we explore what kind of Patreon bonuses we might institute in our second season, I thought it might be worth checking out how these outtakes might be used to get some extra information to you folks, our fans. So give it a listen. I'm going to insert just a little bit of context added in between each of the clips, because they don't make too much sense just heard on their own. So I hope you enjoy it. Please let us know what you think by emailing franchisefestival@gmail.com or going to our website and leaving a comment on the post. Thanks for listening. In this clip, we talk just a bit about how the difficulty curve plays out in Twilight Princess. As you can tell, I had a harder time with it than everybody else.
This is a little harder than Wind Waker, isn't it, Spencer?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I guess if you don't get the sword techniques, it's harder than Wind Waker.
Yeah, it hasn't been too bad. There have only been a couple spots where I was stuck. One was my own fault, and one is a specific puzzle in the Sacred Grove, which I would rank in as one of the hardest puzzles I've ever encountered in a Zelda game, period.
Yeah. Is the last one? With the guardians,
the two statues. Yep.
Oh yeah. I read an interview where the interviewer was all but berating Aonuma about this puzzle, and Aonuma told him, like, you just have to brute force it. You just have to play it until you win.
The problem is, like, it's just not fun, and that's like the biggest problem. Is just like you can easily fail. You don't really fail it per se. You know what? I'll let Spencer. Go ahead. You can explain.
We should talk about that when we get to the Sacred Grove.
Yeah.
Yeah. But as far as difficulty, apart from that standout, I haven't noticed anything. But again, I also discovered that the jump attack is broken. If you jump attack every enemy, it dies really fast.
Yeah, that would be helpful too. I died a lot in this game. There are mini bosses in this that I died multiple times on.
Did you like the water temple?
I loved it. We'll get into it.
I'm sure we will.
I love pretty much every dungeon in this, with one really key exception that won't turn up until next episode.
In the next clip, Hamilton, Spencer, and I speculate on why so many Japanese video games have fishing minigames, and also talk a little bit about the origins of Twilight Princess's fishing minigame in particular.
So the fishing component is back. Longtime fans of the series will remember that Ocarina of Time had a surprisingly in-depth fishing minigame. Was it in Majora's Mask, guys?
I believe...
I know it was in the 3DS remake of Majora's Mask, but I want to say they added it back in there. I think it might not have been in the original Majora's Mask.
The 3DS port was the one I played for the podcast, so now you got me questioning myself. Because it's the fishing hole, it's in the swamp. Right?
Exactly,
it's an attraction in the swamp.
Yeah.
Huh.
Oh, boy.
So it was. Well, I never fished, I'll be honest.
Well, yeah. Truth be told, fishing is about the last thing that I want to do in a Zelda game. And I don't know if a bunch of fans had expressed this opinion, because I will say it had been taken out entirely for Wind Waker. There was no fishing in Wind Waker, and program director of Twilight Princess, Kazuaki Morita, who had worked on quite a few Zelda games before this and was the reason that there was a fishing minigame in Ocarina of Time, was apparently just really mad about the absence of fishing in Wind Waker. And speaking, actually, Hamilton, to a conversation that you, Jasmine, and I had on the Wind Waker episode, Morita was horrified by the fact that the water was opaque in Wind Waker and that you couldn't see fish swimming around underneath it, which I find a really kind of charming detail to have come out of the interviews on Twilight Princess.
Apart from the one fish you do see swimming around in there and you bait up in every swim.
Exactly, map. Yeah. Hoy small fry and all that. Yeah, I love that fish. But your sort of traditional fishing minigame had gone the way of the dinosaur for at least one major Legend of Zelda game at this point. And Morita brought it back with a vengeance in Twilight Princess. He insisted upon its inclusion, and the staff agreed. So there's quite a bit of fishing in Twilight Princess, at least one occasion where you're required to do it. Or at least two occasions where you're required to do it, now that I think of it. But, you know, there's certainly a big optional fishing minigame here.
It was fascinating to me, like, why they insist on including, like, fishing minigames, especially, like, JRPGs, or... I don't know if that's, like, standard in, like, most, like, Japanese-made games. It was like, I have never, ever enjoyed fishing in, like, any game ever.
Yeah, it's definitely much more of a thing in Japanese games than European or North American games. I don't know specifically why that is, but you know, fishing certainly. I mean, I was going to say fishing seems to be quite a big hobby over there, but it's quite a big hobby here. I don't know. Maybe the intersection of people who fish in North America and video game enthusiasts is like less of a, you know, the Venn diagram doesn't overlap as much here as it does there. I don't know.
I mean, fishing is also a cornerstone of the Japanese economy, history, and culture.
Yeah, good point. Maybe it's maybe it, you know, we have more land that's not near an ocean. I don't know.
I suppose, because like the thing is, like, I actually enjoy fishing in real life.
Who doesn't? Everybody loves to fish.
Well. Hopefully, but yeah. I enjoy it. But it's like in video games, though, it always just seems like, I don't know, just tedious and annoying. But I don't know.
I will be so bold as to suggest that most of the charms of real life fishing, you know, the slow pace and, you know, outdoorsiness of it all, is entirely absent from video game approximations thereof. But that's just one guy's opinion. Anyway, all of that said, in The Legend of Zelda, this one particular guy, Kazuaki Morita, is the main driver behind it. And so he's kind of back in the driver's seat as the program director here in Twilight Princess. So he had his way getting the fishing back into it. Our next clip concerns Twilight Princess's famous Goat Loose minigame, which we were pretty amused by, but couldn't find a good place to squeeze into the episode itself.
So I realized, if we want to be thorough, I realized in retrospect we did leave out a minigame, if you want me to throw in just like a real quick summary of the one we got.
Yeah, sure. Which one was it?
Goat herding.
I assumed you guys had covered this while I was away.
I purposely didn't even cover this.
Goat loose! Goat loose!
I purposely did not cover this one, but if you want to, go for it. I hated it.
I don't know that we need to cover this, if I'm being honest. I think we covered it in kind of explaining it a little bit in the Goron section where it was relevant. I'm going to have to cut a lot of content here to get us down to under 2 hours, so I don't mind not covering this.
All right.
I know, sorry.
Dumb and annoying.
But there's a neat little thing. After you herd the goats, for some inexplicable reason, the guy makes you get out of the goat farm by jumping the gates with a Epona.
You're right.
And I can't think of any reason for that other than to just be a nod to Ocarina of Time.
You can't even, like, escape it. Like, this is your fate. If you never figured out how to jump that fence, that would be your entire Twilight Princess gameplay.
Can you imagine, like, going to be, like... You know, you gotta go and do some contract work on a ranch. You know, you're there to herd some goats. Like, yeah, okay, you know, I gotta make a dollar here or there. I gotta pay my bills. And then the person who hired you tells you, you need to ride your horse to the edge and leap over the gate that I will not open to escape.
Oh, by the way, that gate's broke. It only opens from the outside. You're going to have to jump it.
Feels like the start to a horror movie.
This is an allegory to your fate. This is what you do forever.
Yeah. Now that you mention it, there's a lot of weird stuff going on during that goat herding minigame.
Ugh, I hate that stupid minigame.
Goat loose! Man, I love goat loose.
And the fact that if you holler at them enough, they actually attack you.
Yeah. What a lot of programming for something that, Lord willing, you'll only see once.
The next clip describes a pretty surprising moment in Twilight Princess where Link can talk to Epona. We were unaware of any other instance in the series where this happens, so we described it here.
So something that I think I failed to put into the notes, but that I wanted to note for Wolf Link, is that Wolf Link can talk to animals.
That's actually important, too.
Exactly, yeah. It's plot critical when you're in Hyrule Castle Town, because the humans are all scared of you. And the only way to progress through the plot is by finding a cat. I believe her name is Louise. Telma's cat.
Louise.
Yeah, Telma's cat, as it were.
Yeah, Telma's cat.
Yeah, and so you talk to her as Wolf Link. But one of the really odd things that I noted about this is that if you play your cards right, you can talk to Epona as Wolf Link. And it feels like something that should not be. Yeah, you can later on in the game summon Epona as Human Link, then turn into Wolf Link and talk to Epona, and Epona will ask you to turn back into a human as soon as possible.
Huh. I've never tried that.
Yeah, I don't know what possessed me. It occurred to me that I was Wolf Link and Epona was standing there, and I was like, well, I could talk to the cats. I wonder if you can talk to Epona. And I did, and I thought, gosh, this character shouldn't have dialogue. I'm sure it's the only time Epona ever talks in a Zelda game.
This clip serves as an extension of our Arbiter's Ground section, in which we talk about missed opportunities for the spinner.
Did you have anything else on this dungeon, Spencer?
Yeah, because I had mentioned missed opportunity with the spinner specifically. You get the spinner, and one of the things you'll run into in this dungeon once you get it, we mentioned locking into these grooves that the spinner will move along on walls.
Right.
Kind of a common tactic is it will have two of those grooves parallel to one another, and there will be some kind of obstacle, and you can press a button to jump, and then you'll kind of lock into the groove on that kind of parallel wall, and you can jump back.
I love this. I just have to say, I adore that. It's just something about it is so like fun in a very tactile way.
It is cool, but there's one room in this dungeon where you have a lot of parallel walls that it's kind of different potential tracks that become parallel with one another at different points, and there's a critical path through it. So when you get in this room, you not only have to kind of look at the hole, figure out where you need to go, plan a route through it, and then jump between walls to make sure you go where you need to go in the correct direction you need to go while avoiding enemies and obstacles on that wall. It feels like a real bona fide platforming puzzle that you would run into in like a platforming game, and it's excellent. It's my favorite room in this dungeon, and it's really nice. And I wanted more of that, because outside of that room, and I think maybe one other instance where they do something interesting with the spinner, a lot of the puzzles, you will just see a gap you can't get across, and there will just be a groove, and the puzzle you are solving is, oh, I use the spinner here, and you just move on a straight line across a gap that was impassable prior to getting it. It doesn't require any planning, thought, or execution. It's just, it's just adventure game ass use A on B kind of puzzle solving, which is real missed potential, especially considering how well they do it in again like one room. And if I recall, when I navigated through that room, I got a piece of heart. So I don't think you even need to really fully engage with that to get through the dungeon. That's optional stuff.
Yeah, I will be so bold as to suggest just, in a purely speculative sense, that the spinner was a late addition to Twilight Princess. Some evidence for this is the fact that the Arbiter's Grounds feels like a bifurcated dungeon.
Yeah.
It seems entirely possible that the second half of Arbiter's Grounds was added to it later in development. The spinner virtually never gets used outside of Arbiter's Grounds.
Really
there are a couple of places on the overworld that you can use it to get a piece of heart.
And there are a couple of times when you use it later on to, you know, rotate some gears. But that could have easily been a switch in an earlier phase of development. So I wonder if part of the reduced application of the spinner is just related to how late it was introduced in development.
That would make sense.
The one piece of evidence against that is how key it is to the Stallord fight. But, you know, Stallord could have been added late in development, too. Who knows?
Well, Stallord kind of falls into that same pitfall. Because the way that boss arena is set up, at least for the second half, it's you've got a pillar in the middle with grooves on the outside, and then an outer wall. So it's that same principle. You just have a spiral up on both sides, yep. And you jump back and forth.
Yep.
I wanted another wrinkle in this fight. Because it cinematically, this looks very cool. You are moving very fast on that spinner. And the room is very
large.
So it looks very cool as you're spinning around, jumping back and forth between these two things. But there's no real navigation involved. It boils down to just press the spinner button when there's a fireball on the wall you're on.
Yeah.
It would have been nice if there was something akin to, like in the 2D Zeldas, you know, they've got some, there's like minecart puzzles are kind of common where you need to change the track to navigate where you need to go. If maybe after hitting the boss once or twice, they added a mechanic where you needed to, I don't know, shoot something with your bow while you were moving to change the trajectory of the track. Just something. I just wanted one more wrinkle in this fight to make me have to do something more than press the spinner button when there was an obstacle in front of me.
Yeah.
In order to
Yeah, isn't that kind of the story of the boss fights in Twilight Princess? Like, each of them sort of feels like a cool spectacle and an engaging central mechanic that ends up being a bit underdeveloped.
We'll go. Maybe I'll rant about this more at the end, but Twilight Princess as a whole to me kind of fell in the category of, by the end of it, I feel like it wasn't doing enough to engage me.
Yeah.
You will be 20 hours into this game and still be doing puzzles like, oh, there's a pot next to this switch. I will pick up the pot and put it on the switch. And now the door's open. Like, I know Zelda's not. I know Zelda's intended to be something of a breezy experience, but you need to ramp up a little bit.
Yeah. Well, speaking of ramping up, I think we're ready to ramp up the story here.
Good segue.
With the Mirror of Twilight and the history of a certain character who we have encountered in prior Zelda games. Our next clip gives a little bit more context for the Temple of Time and the lead-up to it, which involves traveling on a golden cuckoo and chasing down the Skull Kid a second time. So Link needs to make use of a golden cuckoo to fly on over to the Sacred Grove again and gain access to the Temple of Time.
He also has to return the Master Sword, I believe, to the pedestal. Briefly. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, like doing that opens the Temple of Time, doesn't it?
It opens the Temple of Time.
Yeah, you have to do another section where you chase the Skull Kid through the Lost
Woods. I was just kind of going to skip this because it, you know, well, you know, I guess it does speak to the pacing issue. It's just a reprise of the earlier Skull Kid portion.
Now, I don't know if this is an intended difference or if I just didn't notice it the first time around. The first time we did the Skull Kid chase, I relied a lot more on the sound of his flute to find him, whereas this time while you're chasing him, it seems like you catch glimpses of his lantern down different hallways, and that's how I chased him the second time through.
I used the lantern the first time. The lantern is also present in the first time.
Okay.
I use a lantern as well. At least the first time around. The second time, actually, no, I think I used a lantern as well. The first time I ever played this game on the Wii, I used his flute.
Yeah, the lantern usually, the light gets you to the room that he's in, and the flute noise gets you to where he is in the room.
Yeah.
But anyway, you reprise that section and end up at the Temple of Time. This clip is a much more in-depth description of the interminable fetch quest that happens in the run-up to the City in the Sky Temple. Unfortunately, in cutting this out of the main episode, we also lost the Sheikah Village sequence, And that in particular, I think, is worth dwelling on a little bit, especially because it's one of Spencer's favorite parts of the game.
Basically, Shad tells you to go upstairs to the room above the underground chamber, talk to Ilya, and help her get her memory back. Link meets with Ilya. Ilya tells Link to talk to Renato, the shaman. The shaman has a letter for Telma back in Hyrule Castletown, so Link needs to warp from Kakariko Village to outside of Castletown, go into Castletown, talk to Telma. Telma gives Link something to give back to Ilya. Link teleports back to Kakariko Village to give that to Ilya, thinking that it will restore her memory. In fact, all it does is remind her that she stayed with a mysterious individual in a lonesome, forgotten village at the edge of Hyrule. So at this point, Link needs to figure out where that village is. It's in fact sort of north of Elden and east of Zora's domain. It's in kind of this mountain pass between the two. It's beyond a series of rocks that Link formerly couldn't get through, and requires one of the Gorons to help him get through it now. So the Goron breaks down the rock barrier, and Link heads into this village. And I think we'll pause for just a moment in the fetch quest here, because this village sequence is kind of the high point of the of this portion of the game. Spencer, did you want to tell us about this? Because I think you got quite a kick out of this portion.
I loved this little section. It came out of nowhere. I have absolutely no idea what made them decide to do this.
Yeah.
But you enter this little village, and the Goron warns you that there's 20 enemies up ahead, and you want to try to shoot them without them seeing you.
And yeah, this is the explicit stealth sequence.
Yeah, well,
or more accurately, a sequence that the player is encouraged but not required to use stealth.
Yeah, but it is straight out of a Western. You walk into what looks like an abandoned ghost town. It's that kind of stereotype. It's that trope imagery that you think, where you just have the one narrow, dusty alleyway with buildings and saloons on either side. You have bublins on watchtowers, up on railings, in windows with explosive barrels. The music turns Western. I don't know if
I'll dub some of that in here.
Hey, dubbing some of that Western music, and you just kind of go through shooting these bubblins with your bow or shooting the barrels next to them, and they explode, and they crack, you know, I'm surprised there's no Wilhelm scream here as they flail and fall forward and crash through the railing as they fall from like the second floor onto like the dusty kind of street. It's just real, I don't know, it's a very specific scene that they constructed and that you play through. It seems weird and out of place, and I loved it.
Yeah, it's straight out of a John Wayne Western. It's a really odd choice, although it is a little bit in keeping with, Kakariko Village also has this kind of American Western way about it, though it's not quite as heightened as this sequence.
Right.
So I'm not sure why Westerns were such an influence on a handful of sequences in Twilight Princess. I've never read any statements on it, but it is a pretty cool little scene here. Yeah.
After you beat all the bubblins, you rescue Impa with a
yes,
Z
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Just a quick note on this character. Again, a fun fact pulled from the Hyrule Historia. Impas was also originally a male character. It would have been the first Impa archetype in a Zelda game to be male, but instead they ended up sticking with sort of the elderly Impa, the elderly woman Impa.
At this point in the fetch quest, you have to bounce back and forth between this hidden village and Kakariko a couple times, and I don't know if I just missed something, but I did not have a convenient warp point back here.
No, so, there's not one.
Yeah, it was very annoying to have to warp either to Zora's domain or
kind of like western Hyrule field and then ride Epona back here every single time.
Yeah, and you bounce back and forth. Now mercifully, you do get an item around this portion of the game that lets you summon Epona anywhere, which is nice. Ilya gives it to you.
Yeah, Ilya's charm.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe mm-hmm. it's Impa's who gives it to you.
Impa's gives it you the charm, and when you bring the charm back to Ilya, it jars her memory. It brings her memory back, and it turns out that charm was originally made for you, and she intended to give it to you before you went on your journey, so she gives it to you now.
There you go, and that's what unlocks the ability to summon Epona anywhere. At this point, of course, you then need to jump back to Kakariko, back to the abandoned village, where you're able to restore the Dominion Rod's power thanks to Impa's. Just a quick note on the abandoned village that I thought was interesting, doing a little bit more research into this, and I think Hamilton will get quite a lore kick out of this. One of the strange connections here between Twilight Princess and Ocarina of Time is that it's heavily implied, not heavily implied, it is subtly implied that the abandoned village is Ocarina of Time's Kakariko village. Yes, the giant billboard, and it's pretty funny that there's a giant billboard in a Zelda game, but the giant billboard that stands on top of one of the buildings in the abandoned village, is written in Hylian, but if translated into English, because the Hylian alphabet translates into, the English alphabet, which is kind of, you know, it's a little silly, but whatever. If translated, it, says, "Welcome to Old Kakariko Village." So this is the precursor to Twilight Princess's Kakariko Village, which is off, further to the southeast of here. And it's noted, by the Goron that lets you into there, that the village had been, founded by, effectively the Sheikah, who don't really make an appearance in this game, but that they have disappeared over the years. Impa's tells you that she's the descendant of the person who founded the village. And if you'll recall, in Ocarina of Time, Kakariko Village in that had been founded by a distant ancestor of that game's Impa. So it all kind of comes together to suggest that the abandoned village is in fact Ocarina of Time's Kakariko Village, which was at some point abandoned between the events of that game and this game. Of course, like architecturally, it doesn't resemble that game's Kakariko Village at all. But, like, I mean, that's art design, you know, like, none of the areas in this are a strict one-to-one with the areas in Ocarina of Time. They're kind of reimagined, but, you know, they certainly have their parallels. Pretty cool, though, huh?
That is very interesting. Huh.
Yeah, I took a real weird lore dive on that one, because I encountered references to it, and I was like, oh, that's really weird. And the more that I read about it, the more I was like, oh, this is kind of a slam dunk. That's pretty cool. Yeah, and it is kind of a bummer that the Sheikah aren't really present in this game. The Sheikah, for those who haven't listened to earlier episodes, are the kind of mystic, kind of ninja tribe that Impa belongs to that exists in the world of Hyrule. They're in some Zelda games and not others. They were heavily prominent in Ocarina of Time. They were then absent, if memory serves, in The Wind Waker. And then they make a reappearance a little bit here. They're kind of referenced here. Impa's certainly is descended from the Sheikah. And Zelda's cloak that she's wearing has the Sheikah icon on the back of it. As well as the fortune teller in Hyrule Castle Town has a Sheikah eye tattoo on her, suggesting that she too is descended from the Sheikah, and that's why she can read the future. But otherwise, the Sheikah, much like the Gerudo, are entirely absent from this game. So anyway, back to the fetch quest. The Dominion Rod is reactivated. Link can head on back to Shad at this time, underneath Kakariko Village, where he's given a book. Actually, does Impa's give him the book, or does Shad give him the book? Do you guys recall?
I believe Impus gives him the book, and then Shad reads it, and that's what that's reactivates it. The Dominion Rod. But it doesn't activate the statue that you're trying to activate.
There you go. Gosh, thank you. So Impus gives Link... I'm probably just going to dub this portion in. So Impus gives Link the a book that can be used to translate the text that Shad is trying to translate underneath Kakariko Village. So when Link takes the book to Shad, it reactivates the Dominion Rod, which is neat. But Shad is unable to read the book because there are portions of it missing. Now at this point, somebody might assume that you can use the Dominion Rod on that statue that's plainly designed for it underneath Kakariko Village, move it, and get into the little secret chamber. This is not true. There's effectively a big stone bicycle lock on the statue, and so Link is now tasked with traveling around to statues all across Hyrule, as well as Gerudo Desert, and I think there's one in Ordona, down kind of in the forest where the game started, to move these statues around in extremely brief rudimentary puzzles to stand on a glowing platform and fill in the book, at which point Link can go back to Shad underneath Kakariko Village and have him finally speak the magical words aloud, which lets Link into the secret chamber underneath Kakariko Village.
I have something of a segue here, if you're willing to let me jump in.
Please do. We got to get out of this section.
Yeah, so this, well, it's about the problem with bad rewards for optional puzzles in this game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because
help
as
me
you
on here.
Travel around and find those owl statues that you need to use the Dominion Rod to move, in order to fill in the book that you need to do to progress through the story, all you really have to do is move the statue, and then there will be a little glowing circle where the statue is standing. You step on it, and you get what you need to move on. But I didn't do this with all of these, but I stopped, if I'm being honest, I stopped looking that hard. So in most of these, at least, if you kind of look around, you realize there's an optional puzzle you can do, where once you move that owl statue, you can position it such that you can access treasure chests that you could not access before the rod. And it was always rupees for me.
I had the exact same experience. I only did half of them because after the third, I was like, no, I don't need any more rupees.
Yeah, and it's a real shame how that undercuts this, because I like that that design choice. Having a puzzle with optional middle steps that make it harder but give you a reward for doing it is kind of a standard structure.
Yeah.
Like a lot of games do it. Final Fantasy X kind of comes to mind with the Cloister of Trials. You know, if
Point.
Optional steps in the middle of those, you get like an item that you can't
get.
Yeah,
cool
otherwise,
bonus.
Things like that. So I like that idea, but doing it and then opening a treasure chest with 50 rupees in it feels like a gut punch, because I don't know. I was just about always maxed out on rupees.
Yeah.
There's not a lot to spend it on. There's a couple notable kind of money sink side quests. But if you haven't just finished, you know, giving 1,000 rupees to Mallow for that side quest, you always have plenty of rupees. The reward for completing that question to the end is armor that makes you invulnerable while constantly draining your rupees. So if you went that route, I guess maybe you'd want these. But in 9 times out of 10, this feels like such a hollow, crappy reward for figuring that out. It made me stop trying to do them.
Yeah, it's pretty mystifying, too, in that because this game requires 5 heart pieces to, increase Link's life meter, there are a comparative abundance of heart pieces in this game. So why weren't any of them rewards for this quest?
Yeah. And also, boy, let me tell you, the worst are Hylian stamps. I don't think these were present in the original game, right? These are a Wii U edition for the Miiverse.
Exactly. Yeah, we talked briefly about this in the development section of episode 12. But yeah, these are effectively like little pieces of art or Hylian letters.
I didn't even try to get these.
Yeah, they're in addition to the HD remake. They consistently replace rupees. So where there were an even greater abundance of rupees in the original game, in the remake, they are sometimes these stamps. I liked this because when I played the game on the HD version, Miiverse was still active, and so I got to make some, you know, zany Twilight Princess art with it. But since they shut down Miiverse a few years ago, these are somehow even more hollow rewards than 50 rupees.
Yeah, they're pretty stone useless. And if I could muster up any defense at all for them, these are usually not very far out of the way.
Yeah.
They're the simplest of the puzzles. Usually if you see an unlit torch somewhere and you light that torch and a chest pops up next to it, you know it's going to be a Hylian stamp.
Right.
But there were a handful of times where it was enough out of the way that I thought I was about to get a heart piece. And when it turns out to be a Hylian stamp, it is a real bad feeling.
It is. Yeah. Yeah, it's... go on.
Nah. I was about to say, just like, there are certain heart pieces that, when I felt like I couldn't get, like, a really good reward for, like, doing a whole lot of, questing, I'll be honest, this time around, I kind of looked up stuff. I had a guide.
Yeah.
The very first time I played this, again, when it first came out, 2008, or whenever it was released, I really went into it blind. And that was fun at the time, but now it's just like, I used a guide to find a few of the heart pieces. And also, at least with our playthroughs, like, I haven't been 100%ing them in terms of like trying to go for every nook and cranny for a heart piece.
Yeah, admittedly, this game does not reward our approach to these, I think, quite as much, in that it's a very slow burn. And, you know, if it's the only game you're playing, if it's, you know, something new that just came out, and you're sort of meandering through maybe over the course of a summer or something, it's pretty cool. If you're trying to, to make it to the end and do a pretty critical read of it, it doesn't quite stand up to scrutiny or the breakneck pace required to podcast on it.
Mm-hmm.
The next clip covers the mid-bosses and somewhat incongruous enemies of the city in the sky. There are kind of mini mid-bosses here. The Aerolphos is the main mid-boss, and that's who you get the double claw shot from. It's a Lizalfos that can fly, and that Link needs to claw shot to bring down to the ground. And there's also an oversized Baba, one of the plant enemies, a big Baba, that Link needs to defeat in an area. But neither are really particularly noteworthy, I don't think.
I couldn't figure out why they included a big Baba here.
Nope, because doesn't make any sense.
You need to... Previously, because I mean, when you beat it, when you beat the head part, you need to finish it off by throwing a bomb into its body.
Yeah.
And you don't need bombs anywhere else in this dungeon, so it's not like there's a reason for you to be short on bombs. So this isn't a resource check like a Resident Evil boss would be.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I was scratching my head when I fought this.
Yeah, it almost felt like a boss subbed in from another dungeon.
Yeah.
Yeah, this kind of added it.
Yeah, it's very odd here.
Doesn't really make any sense. I guess it goes with the whole pacing of the game, which, again, I'm trying to put a pin in because I want to talk. I'm sure we'll all discuss that, but sometimes it just seems like, again, it's too many ideas. I don't know if it's too many cooks in one kitchen, but it's just like...
too many cooks.
You're trying really hard to, like, make something make sense.
Uh-huh.
But then you try so hard to do it that you, like, add little bits and pieces here that don't tie in with the theme of what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But even thematically, it doesn't belong, but mechanically, someone had to say to themselves, when putting this monster here specifically, someone had to have said, we need to put this here to make sure the player has saved at least one bomb so that they can progress. But I don't know why in the world that checkpoint would be additive to any experience. And also, there's nothing in this dungeon that would cause a player to be short on bombs. There's constantly chests everywhere that give you like stacks of 20 bombs, and there's nothing you need to blow up, at least going off of memory.
Yeah, to like, get what's going on stuff. With that? Yeah, yeah, that's really strange.
This is one of the most head-scratching moments.
Like, all
I
the enemies
the
here Sorry. Like all the enemies here just don't fit a sky dungeon. I mean,
yeah,
I guess it's
there's
like
a lot of babas. Why are there so many like plants overgrown in a city in
yeah
the sky?
Because, like, how would it get overgrown? It's in the sky.
Yeah.
And then you have, like, helmosaurs and things like that. And
right.
It's like, well, how did they get here?
Yeah, it's... It really speaks to... are there any unique enemies in this dungeon besides the Aralphos? Those
this
oversized helmosaurs...
Oh, there's like the floating root masses that you clash
onto. The P-hats?
You know, those appear in Gerudo Desert, too. Because they're a way to get over the sort of crevasses in Gerudo Desert.
Oh, there's a Kargarok.
Oh, no, the Kargarok is the Twilight monster that you had to fight to fly up through Zora's Domain.
Is it? Okay.
So that appeared earlier, too.
Then I don't think there's a single... Besides the P-hat, well, because you said the P-hat...
Yeah, the P-hat's earlier, too.
Another place, so no,
yeah,
there's nothing here.
I think the Aralphos is the only... there's an oversized version of the Helmasar that I think makes its debut here, but it's just a larger Helmasar.
Yeah, the wiki differentiates them as Helmasar and Helmasaurus.
Oh, okay, there
so
you go.
So you encounter Helmasaurus here.
Yeah, yeah, I'll give it that.
Which is also like, how did you get up here? How would you survive up here?
Yeah, it's definitely, it's one of those things that's best not to think too critically about. Much like the Uku or Uka architects.
I know.
In this clip, Hamilton and I talk a little bit about Zelda's never-explained resurrection at the climax of Twilight Princess.
Was it ever explained, like, why she just exists
No,
again?
No, it's not.
Okay.
And it shouldn't annoy me. It doesn't really matter. But it sure seemed to imply that she died earlier.
Well, she disappeared. She was supposed to have lost her physical body. She gave her life to Midna. But then he has her body.
Yeah, this is a big old plot hole. There's just, as far as I'm aware, there's nothing here. There's no connective tissue here. Zelda simply disappeared earlier in the game in, like, a plot-critical sacrifice, but then she's back here.
It just undoes it. It's like...
It does.
And this is one thing... So, listeners, one thing that really annoys me about story mechanics is, like, just stay as close to your story as you can, and don't take away from important... Don't take away from important events that are leading to either character growth or things like that, unless there's a really good reason as to why you're doing it. Those who have played Final Fantasy VII through its entirety, I don't need to tell you a scene that you know. But you also know that scene is permanent.
There are 80 articles on the internet that'll tell you how to revive her.
There's no Phoenix Down strong enough. There's no Phoenix Down strong enough. And I won't spoil this for anyone who has not played it. But
sure,
go ahead and play. It's a fantastic game.
Yeah.
But that change, at least in that game, is permanent.
Yep.
The weight of it you feel.
In our final clip, we talk about cut characters from Twilight Princess, funny enough, in a cut clip from the show, as well as briefly discussing the Cave of Ordeals side quest. Just real quick, two side characters who were designed for this game, but who did not appear in the final version of it. The Hyrule Historia has concept art of Sheik as drawn for Twilight Princess, though of course Sheik never made it into the final version of Twilight Princess. The second side character who didn't make it into the game, but is referenced in the game, is the Zora King. There was a Zora King designed for Twilight Princess in the concept art, but who is long deceased at the time of the game's events. You can find his grave in the cemetery by Kakariko Village. But he looks hilarious in the concept art, as opposed to the queen of the Zoras, who's pretty humanoid and looks like a standard Zora. The King Zora looks kind of like a tiny shark with human legs.
Yikes! That's interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing. I would strongly recommend, again, kind of like Mallow, listeners look up concept art for King Zora in Twilight Princess, because he's very silly. Anyway, I think that pretty well wraps up characters, so let's do just a little bit of miscellany here real quick. The first is the Cave of Ordeals. We didn't really touch on this in the main story because it's an optional side quest, but Link can engage in a 50-floor challenge dungeon where you just need to complete... each floor has a combat encounter, and it really makes use of kind of all of the tools from throughout Twilight Princess. It's definitely the hardest portion of the game if you choose to engage with it. I did when I played this back in 2016. I did not when playing it for the show here.
I have not done it for this show, but I did do it back 2008? Is it 2009? When did
2006 is when the game originally came out.
But I remember playing it in college. When did I start college?
That would have been 2006. Yeah, we were both there in 2006.
Guys, listeners, it's been so long. I'm aging myself right now. I'm aging myself. Yeah. I'm just like, wait, what year?
We're not getting any younger, man.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, back in the day when I really wanted to 100% right. this, so I do remember doing it then. Not so much now.
Did you ever do this, Spencer?
Back in 2006, yes, yeah. I did. Did not do it this time.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool when I did it. You know, it adds a lot of time onto the game, and it's really tough. So, you know, with a pretty limited schedule here for the show, it didn't make a lot of sense to do. But it is the only appearance in Twilight Princess of the Great Fairy. The Great Fairy appears in the Cave of Ordeals, but otherwise you'd never know that there was a Great Fairy in Twilight Princess. And that's all of the cut content we had for Twilight Princess that was substantial enough to revisit here in a bonus episode. Be sure to let us know what you think by emailing us at franchisefestival@gmail.com or visiting our website to submit a comment there. As ever, thank you so much for listening, folks.